Would you describe yourself as an anti-psychiatrist?
Of course not. Anti-psychiatrist sounds like anti-Semite or anti-Christian or even anti-religion. I'm not anti-religion. I just don't believe in it. Anybody who wants to have a religion is fine. Anybody who wants to go to a psychiatrist is fine. Anyone who wants to take psychiatric drugs is fine with me. That's right. Anti-psychiatry is completely inaccurate. I'm no more anti-psychiatry than pro-psychiatry. I'm for freedom and responsibility. Responsibility comes first. People ought to be responsible for themselves. And if they are not, they should reap the consequences of it. I don't necessarily mean that we should be sadistic to them or punish them, but they should suffer the consequences. If a person becomes addicted to drugs, he should suffer the consequences of that drug, because nobody made him take the drug.
All in the Mind on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for tuning in. It was 1961 when a book called The Myth of Mental Illness sent sparks flying throughout the world, especially in the large community of people diagnosed with mental illnesses and the psychiatrists treating them. Nearly 50 years later, the author of that book joins me in conversation over the next two shows on the eve of his 89th birthday. He's a contentious figure. Hungarian-born, a New York-based psychiatrist and libertarian, Emeritus Professor Thomas Sartz has strong ideas that will offend some, engage others, and is the sort of guest that will definitely make you talk out loud at the radio as you're listening. I had about 20 comeback questions for every one of his answers, so you will too. Professor Sartz has, though, provoked many ethical and legal debates over complex issues like the role of psychiatrists, over the classification and diagnosis of mental illnesses, the insanity defence, drug legalisation, involuntary hospitalisation and treatment, human rights, patient-assisted suicide. So much so that even his critics acknowledge his huge legacy with comments like these. Sartz has done singular service to psychiatry in asserting the rights of patients and fighting abuses perpetrated in the name of treatment. Or this one, more than anyone else, Sartz has stirred interest in law and psychiatry. Those comments from a heated collection of essays called Sartz Under Fire, The Psychiatric Abolitionist Faces His Critics. And in a third show, we'll have discussants to reflect on Thomas Sartz's controversial legacy, and we really invite your comments too on this one via the All in the Mind website or on the blog. But today, a sitting with Thomas Sartz himself. Well, Thomas Sartz, thanks for joining me on ABC Radio National.
Thank you.
Look, you were born in Budapest in 1920, but left Hungary, escaped Hungary with your family in World War II to migrate to the USA. And that was in 1938, you were 18. You suggest, though, that it was long before you entered medical school, even before you came to the USA, that you came to view mental illnesses as non-diseases. So your ideas were formed very early on. I must ask, what prompted you then to train as a doctor and a psychiatrist?
The essence is that I was very interested in medicine and hard sciences from a very early, relatively early age, and the educational system in Budapest at that time was very, very good. So I had a very good education in chemistry, physics, mathematics, and the humanities also. I lived in a very intellectual atmosphere and family, and thanks to them, I became an omnivorous reader, and a very early understood what a disease is in a scientific modern sense. A disease is some kind of an abnormality of the human body, and that the mind is obviously semantically, linguistically, is not a part of the human body. So there was a first question about mental illness. The second one was that the most obvious thing about mental illness, about the psychiatric profession, which distinguishes it from other specialties in medicine, that mental patients, by and large, if they are ill, are locked up. They are prisoners. They're not patients. They can get into the hospital, but they can't get out. Now, this is still true, of course. So I put two and two together and concluded that this is a social phenomenon which has nothing to do with medicine. And of course, there is lots of evidence for this in literature. I mean, Chekhov, who was himself a doctor, has several stories. I mean, the one that is most striking, and I highly recommend to read, Ward Number 6, written around 1892. The protagonist is a psychiatrist and describes the place as a concentration camp. Now, of course, growing up in Budapest, there were mental hospitals there too. I read the newspapers, I heard stories from people, and it was obvious that this was not a desirable place to be in, because people were locked up. Really, end of story.
You say you went to medical school not because you wanted to practice medicine, but because you wanted to know medicine. Is that the same for your decision to train as a psychiatrist?
Not quite. I also realized way back in my teens that not all the things which is called psychiatry is locking people up. There was another kind of psychiatry which had developed actually, well, but not very long before I was born, called psychoanalysis. Now, that was a form of counseling, obviously. Two people, an analyst and the patient, were talking to each other. The analyst was trying to help the patient. The patient lived at home and paid the doctor just like any other professional. So actually, I was interested in that aspect of, quote, psychiatry.
And yet the American tradition of psychoanalysis that you encountered and trained in the 1950s as a young man was, you know, very different from the European tradition of your youth, wasn't it?
It was not different, it was opposite. It was completely medicalized. The analysts all believed that they were treating a mental illness. Now, of course, they had no criterion for mental illness. They called other people mentally ill if they didn't like them. But that was not a problem because I kept my ideas to myself until I had some economic security. Because, you know, they still did a kind of psychoanalysis, and this was still a skill that, if you can call it that, it's an intimate, confidential conversation. And I was perfectly happy to learn that and to practice that actually for virtually my whole life, for almost 50 years.
Well, we'll come to your approach to psychotherapy a little later, but you've written, of course, countless books since. Let's remind people of perhaps your most famous, your most controversial, The Myth of Mental Illness, which was published in 1961. You know, The Myth of Mental Illness caused lots of consternation amongst the mental health professions when it was published, and still does to an extent, I have to say. In it, you described mental illness as a fiction, as a metaphor, and psychiatry as a pseudoscientific racket. Let's unravel what you meant by mental illness as a metaphor.
It's a metaphor in the same sense in which the term mind is a metaphor. There is no mind. It's a fiction. Although we all think we have a mind, we think that it's our mind that remembers, speaks, or thinks, or has feelings. But obviously there is no mind. This is linguistically problematic in virtually every language, and especially problematic in English, where the mind, since the 1700s, functions as a noun. Originally, there was no mind in English, only as a verb, like minding the store. And that's what I mean by metaphor. A verb is something which we do. It's not something which we have.
Well, I mean, you've called it a metaphor. You've also called it a fiction, a myth, on par with fictions such as a witch, a unicorn, a mermaid, a sphinx, a ghost, even God. I mean, you're flying in
absolutely
the face of the accepted understanding of an awful lot of smart people here, aren't you? Doctors, advocates, your colleagues.
Not nearly as many as you imply. This is common sense. Where is your mind? If you can't see it, can't measure it, then by scientific standards, it doesn't exist.
Would you deny, though, that we have mental experiences that are difficult?
No, and I'm not trying to be difficult now or complicated. No, we don't have mental experiences. We have personal experiences, which we put into the mind. See, that is what the mind is, this mysterious storehouse into which we put things. This is really a philosophical issue, and in philosophy, it's not entirely novel.
Well, you've argued, certainly in The Myth of Mental Illness, that strictly speaking, disease or illness can only affect the body, that thoughts and mood, unlike bile and urine, are not material things, so there can be no such thing as a mental illness. Isn't this setting up a false dichotomy between the mind and the body when so many people would now argue that we've confirmed that behaviour, that the mind that drives behaviour is underpinned by a biological organ, the brain?
That is correct. Everything is underpinned by a biological organ. So is running. But if somebody runs well or poorly, in terms of otherwise physically normal person, we don't attribute it to his legs. We attribute it to his person. It's very difficult to explain this because it is, you know, because to me it's obvious. The idea that we have a dichotomy between mind and body is because of the language which we have created, that we have a mind. Now, mental illnesses, what are mental illnesses? Give me an example of a mental illness.
Well, let's take a mental illness that you've described as the sacred symbol of psychiatry, schizophrenia.
Well, that would be the most difficult one to start with, but let's start with a simpler one.
Okay, what about depression?
Well, depression, how is depression different from sadness? Depression is the personal feeling of feeling badly, feeling fatigued, feeling hopeless, helpless. It is in many ways a normal feeling of someone who is in a very bad life situation, who has suddenly lost his money or has suddenly become sick, or typically it's a feeling which, fortunately so far I am okay, which is typical of old people. You go into a nursing home and you look around and it's a depressing place. Well, now what's depressing about it? Everybody's depressed.
Well, certainly there's been a push to describe depression as a mental illness, as a disease, especially prolonged, entrenched depression. You take to task the very concept of a mental disease.
Correct, because if you go back, for example, to the classic descriptions of human behavior, the best and oldest that we have, was Job depressed? Was Lady Macbeth depressed? Well, that's what psychiatrists say now. She had good reason to feel badly. She was guilty of murder. And she treated it by perhaps one of the commonest treatment of depression called suicide. Now, people don't talk like this. You know, that this is taboo. I mean, suicide is a disease too.
Yes, to describe suicide as a self-treatment or a treatment in effect is certainly difficult for people to hear.
Why? It solves the problem. Why do people commit suicide? To get out of life, to get out of this problem.
Psychiatrist Emeritus Professor Thomas Sartz, author of the 1961 classic The Myth of Mental Illness, is my guest on All in the Mind on the eve of his 89th birthday. Yet with Radio National and Radio Australia, I'm Natasha Mitchell. This contentious point about suicide, of course, flies in the face of the careful efforts of suicide prevention strategies worldwide. It ties in with the primacy Professor Sartz places on individual liberty, which we'll take up on the show with him next week. And in this vein, he is in fact against physician-assisted suicide and was vocal against the decision to take Terry Schiavo off life support, for example. Certainly for the past 50 years, Thomas Sartz, you've argued that Western societies have been transformed from a theocracy or a theological state to a democracy, and now you suggest that we're living in a state of a pharmacocracy or a therapeutic state. What do you mean by this idea of a therapeutic state that you've written much about?
Well, I mean in part the very language we are speaking, the very fact that we are discussing depression as a disease, or for that matter, school phobia, or fear of elevators, or schizophrenia.
Who are the keepers of the therapeutic state in your mind?
Who were the keepers of the theocratic state? I mean, the Pope had no armies, as Stalin said. Why do people believe in the Pope? Because they consider him an authority, if you are Catholic. Why do people believe in the rabbinate in Israel? Well, if they are very Jewish, they believe that they know how to live, and you shouldn't eat pork, and you shouldn't work on Saturday, and so on. We believe these pseudo-medical fictions. And by the way, there are not too many physicians who avail themselves of the standard psychiatric treatments. I don't know of any physician who had a lobotomy, and there are very, very few physicians who ever submitted themselves voluntarily to electric shock treatment.
Difficult to quantify. Difficult to quantify.
No, it's not difficult to quantify. I mean, there are statistics about, you can talk to people. This is well known, that psychiatric treatments are for other people.
I mean, you have cast psychiatrists and physicians as, in essence, the high priests of what you call the therapeutic state.
Well, look, in America, there is a person who is called the Surgeon General, who a few years ago announced to the world that smoking is bad for you. Well, I knew that smoking was bad for me when I was 5 years old. That's been known for 150 years. Speaking of metaphors, there are now books that discuss love sickness as a disease. Many of these people now are psychologists, who are kind of pseudo-doctors. Now, what is love sickness? When you say body and mind are separate, if you are heartbroken, you don't have a coronary artery disease, you don't have a heart attack, your heart is broken. Now, everybody knows what that means. People think that they live in their bodies. Now, I submit to you, and this is not a new idea either, that in fact people live in their languages. And you learn this the hard way if you are an immigrant. Because if you really want to become integrated in the society into which you have emigrated, you have to lose your old language. And anybody who listens to this knows that this is true. And the only way to avoid that is by holding on to your old language. And those are the people who may be here for a generation. When they come at 25 and work, and at 60 or 70, they are still talking their own language.
And how does language relate to your critique of mental illness?
That what we call mental illness is, you know what psychiatrists call schizophrenia? They call it a thought disorder. And they describe its primary symptom, what they call language salad, talking gibberish. Not those are linguistic phenomena. Imagine that you are a patient in a psychiatrist's office, in a doctor's office, and you don't say anything. You are taken there by somebody and says, here is Joe, he is sick, doctor. Examine him. And the doctor examines you and finds no bodily illness. Now, how would he find schizophrenia? You haven't opened your mouth yet.
But I guess people look for behavioral indicators according to a whole set of criteria.
What was the word you just used?
Behavioral indicators.
But the key word is behavioral. That's why psychiatrists often call mental illness a behavioral disease. But behavior is not a disease. It cannot be a disease. Only the body can predicate disease.
But this is difficult, otherwise, isn't it? Because disease is a fraught term even in medicine. It doesn't always correspond to a particular lesion or pathology. Disease is a much debated term in the medical professions.
But it's used in metaphoric ways also. Well, life is complicated. But the fact is, if you are an average person and you decide you should have a checkup, you are 55 and you have family history which is not so good, and you decide to make an appointment with this good doctor, the chances are that you will be sent 2 or 3 weeks before the appointment to a laboratory where they will take 3 or 4 or 5 tubes of blood and do all kinds of routine tests on them. Possibly you will be sent to a radiologist to have your chest x-ray taken. Only then will the doctor see you. Now, what is he looking for? He's looking for whether you have tuberculosis, whether you have AIDS, whether you have syphilis, whether you have hypertension, diabetes, and so on. He's examining your body fluids. Now, this is not what psychiatrists do.
What do you see psychiatrists as doing?
Well, they do, and I actually wrote a book, which perhaps you saw, called The Myth of Psychotherapy, in which I say that psychiatrists do one of three things: religion, rhetoric, and repression. Now, to explain that, religion refers to psychiatrists dealing with human values. They tell people to cheer up, not to feel badly about this or that. They counsel them. That's also rhetoric, which is also what part of religion is. Now, rhetoric is the use of language to persuade people. That's the original, classic Greek understanding of rhetoric. Now, that term has become kind of degraded by talking about political rhetoric, which is a kind of lying. But rhetoric is drama, theater, films, psychotherapy. Is rhetoric. Now, repression is a main thing which psychiatrists do. If two legal things happened tomorrow morning, psychiatry would disappear. Involuntary mental hospitalization and the insanity defense in all forms. Psychiatrists incarcerate and otherwise coerce people to do things they don't want to do, like being locked up or taking drugs or being electric shocked, and or they provide excuses to people who have done something bad and are in legal or personal trouble. And then they go to court or otherwise make statements saying this person is mentally ill, is not responsible for what he has done.
I think many psychiatrists are highly dubious about the extent of social power, political power, personal power you suggest that they have. Let's come to one of this most perhaps controversial area of criticism, and that is the insanity defence in law, that people are in effect hospitalised instead of imprisoned if they successfully plead not guilty by reason of insanity. You take a very tough position here. And certainly in early years you testified at a number of high-profile trials on behalf of prosecutors, rebutting the plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. I mean, why are you so concerned about the insanity defence, given that many people would consider it as a great humanising force in law?
All right, let me explain that. Psychiatry being a part of the social fabric, it is not some kind of a conspiracy against the public. It is part of the society that we live in, that we know. I am particularly focused on the insanity defense for cognitive, rhetorical, scientific reasons, because it is perhaps the most important pillar, even more important than involuntary hospitalization, because it is part and parcel of that. It is a link to the false concept of mental illness. Now, here is a legal procedure I am a great believer in principle in the classic Anglo-Saxon tradition of criminal law, of justice, which is quite unique in the world, interculturally, and it's unique historically, in that you have tremendous guarantees in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, in America, in England, that if you are not guilty of a crime, which the prosecution can prove to a jury, then the chances of your being deprived of liberty is very, very small. You have a right to liberty, life, liberty, and responsibility. So these are core concepts, civilizational concepts by which we live. Now, how you can prove that you are not guilty, but how do you prove that you don't have schizophrenia? You can't.
Well, you see the insanity defense as a violation of the principles of the free society based on the rule of law.
Absolutely.
Certainly, it's been well argued that it's a recognition that some people aren't to be held criminally liable for breaking the law because of their mental state at the time of the act, that they were incapable of distinguishing right from wrong.
Well, look, we could spend the whole interview on that because you just, your questions are wonderful, Natasha, thank you, defined it, that they are not responsible for the criminal act at the time of the offense. In the typical insanity defense, let's assume a young man kills another young man on January 1st. On January 2nd, he is caught. He sits in jail waiting for the system to grind on. The chances of coming actually to a jury trial in less than 8 or 9 months is very, very small. But even if it's 8 days, from my argument, it doesn't make any difference. At which point, before the trial, he is examined by a psychiatrist, who then determines that at the time of the trial, this is a so-called McNaughton rule, but in point of fact, the psychiatrist didn't see him at the time of the offense. He only sees him 8 days or 8 months later.
What's your concern about that? Because certainly you've been much criticised in your expert testimonies that you didn't assess the suspect. You didn't assess in making your judgment. And in fact, some people have accused you of medical incompetency and irresponsibility for making a statement about a person without examining them.
Of course, because this is heresy. Even the term psychiatric testimony is not correct, because whatever I would testify, and I only testified for the prosecution in those cases, and only very few cases, I testified with the understanding that I don't examine the defendant, because the defendant is not a patient. He doesn't become a patient until somebody calls him a patient. He's not sick, and my testimony is to the effect that this is a job for the jury to decide whether he is guilty or not, not for a professional who doesn't know anything about what happened, who wasn't there. Any more than the jury.
But do you accept that some people aren't necessarily mentally competent to have been aware of the consequences of their actions?
Absolutely accept it.
And so isn't there a place for the insanity defence on that basis?
No. There's a place for calling people demented or senile. Some old person, my God, if I live long enough, this could happen. You know, I don't know who my daughter is. That's called incompetence. Incompetent people are par excellence incompetent to commit a complicated crime. Who is a most typical defendant, insanity defendant now in America? John Hinckley Jr., a young man who has been now cured of schizophrenia for something like 26 or 27 years. This is a young man who tried to shoot President Reagan, and he managed to shoot Reagan and two other people within a few seconds. So this was a highly coordinated attack performance. I compare him to Toscanini. He's a genius at shooting people. He was not incompetent. He brought shame to his family, committed a great crime. He was pronounced insane against his will. He wrote a letter, which he managed to get out, to Newsweek magazine, which was published, in which he said, I want to plead guilty. By law, he couldn't plead guilty because you can't plead guilty to a capital offense in America because that's tantamount to committing suicide with the aid of the state. This is a legal game.
Thomas Sutz, your position is complex. On the one hand, you've been held up by many anti-psychiatry or mental health activists as a figurehead of their movement, and yet many of your characterisations of people who have been diagnosed with serious mental illness are actually pretty tough. I mean, you blame individuals themselves for their unwell behaviours. You suggest that they need to, in your words, assume responsibility for their predicament and make a sincere attempt at helping themselves.
Well, it's absolutely correct. I don't hold them responsible for their behaviour except insofar as the behaviour is faulty. According to their own selves, they don't assume responsibility for correcting it. My analogy for this is very much something like takes the predicament of an immigrant. Now, an immigrant is not responsible for not speaking English when he gets here. Is he incompetent? No. Many such people have been found incompetent by psychiatrists because they don't speak the language and the psychiatrist gets confused, and the patient is confused, and he's locked up. I mean, these are classic stories. But let's just go further with this. There are innumerable analogies one could draw. So this person now is not living in a society in which his native language is spoken, so he has a problem, right? Now, what's his responsibility? Does he have a responsibility to learn English or whatever the language is? Yes or no?
I mean, I guess in response to this, you know, psychiatrist Professor Ronald Pies has wondered in response to these arguments. He asked you this question. What of the young man rocking back and forth in a pool of his own urine, responding to voices from a CIA computer that are instructing him to kill himself? You know, to bring this young man into hospital against his wishes is not to bully him, but to begin the process of restoring humanity. And I wonder whether, in blaming people for their circumstances, often very catastrophic circumstances and behaviours, that you're denying their suffering?
Well, it's impossible to answer this kind of question because it is based on a story which already validates psychiatry. Now, how do we, where is this man who is walking back and forth in his own urine? I have never seen such a person in more than 50 years of psychiatry. Where is he? How did he get there? Who is he? And how does a psychiatrist know that he's talking to the CIA? There is only one way he could know that, and that's by the patient telling him. And the patient tells you that the CIA is talking to him. Let's assume if someone told me that, I would tell him, well, congratulations, you must be a very important person. That's not against the law.
I mean, in fact, you've described the voices and hallucinations in schizophrenia as being a person's own voices whose authorship they disown.
What else could they be?
Disowned, well, self-conversations or delusions as stubborn errors or lies that the patient is not interested in correcting. And this is tough. You're quite tough in your assessment of people.
You see, you have recognized the correct core of my thought. People think that I am somehow soft on, quotes, patients. I'm neither soft nor hard. I treat them as human beings, just as if they were me or my children or my friends. I take them seriously. They are not less human. And it's only in psychiatry. You see, if you're an internist, if you're a doctor and you have a patient with a broken hip or diabetes or hypertension, he is fully human. He's no less human than you are, than the doctor is. Only in psychiatry do you have this pervasive paternalistic attitude, which the example you cited is a classic example. I mean, it describes the patient as some kind of animal that has to be helped out of his misery. This is not right. Psychiatry is paternalistic because it treats other people as inferiors. Now, this is not true, basically, in psychoanalysis.
Certainly, psychoanalysis has been accused of its fair share of malpractices in relation to its patients.
Absolutely. But malpractice is part of human life. There is no area of life in which you can't abuse the relationship. Granted, priests, psychoanalysts, I'm not holding them up. My only point about psychoanalysis was going to be in the history of psychoanalysis, the typical doctor-patient relationship, and this is going to be a point you have never heard before and probably never hear again. The patient had more power, was of higher social class, had far more money than Freud had. In Freud's day, Freud was a poor Jewish medical practitioner in Vienna. Virtually all his patients were of a much higher class than he and had much more money and much more social power.
And next week we take up this issue of social power and Thomas Sutz's libertarian philosophy. Also, why he doesn't believe in Scientology, even though he's notorious for helping the church establish the Citizens Commission on Human Rights in 1969, which has been vocal against psychiatry ever since. The week after that, the profession itself responds. And yes, we want your thoughts too. Head to abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. The email or the blog for your robust response is there, as is the audio and transcript of the show and the full archive. Our Twitter name is All in the Mind. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow, studio engineer Tim Simons. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next week.
You know him as Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, but actor Viggo Mortensen is a man of many parts. He takes photographs, he writes, he performs his poetry, makes music and soundscapes with Buckethead. And with the money from those big movies, he's founded an art press.
We try to reflect, in the end, no matter who the author is, as close as possible exactly what they see, what they want, how they want their work to be presented, you know.
Movie Time. You can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.